just put this. This can come here. Frill. Okay.
Did you say frill?
What's wrong with that? What?
Really, you said frill? What, you're fucking in the 90s.
Sorry?
You were talking Farscape now.
Do I've got to change my profanity lexicon every decade, do I?
Well, at least not so
I should say frack. I should say frack now,
No,
right?
Because that's finished as well, that show.
What am I allowed to say?
Fuck. Because that still hasn't dated.
But then we'll get an explicit tag.
Oh, yeah, that's never stopped us before.
Well, it's never stopped you before.
You swear as much as I do.
Oh, shut up, Ian. Welcome to The Writer and the Critic, a monthly podcast devoted mostly to speculative fiction books, reviews, and the odd bit of idle gossip. I'm your host, Kirsten McDermott, and sitting to my right is your other host, Ian Mond.
Hello, everyone!
I might just have to turn your microphone down.
No, I'm not going to speak that loudly throughout the show. I just wanted to wake people up.
How are you?
I am really good, thank you. And I don't know what to tell you. I didn't expect you to even ask me how I was.
Oh, why?
You've never asked me that before. I think if we went through the other 17 podcasts, you never asked me that.
Okay, well, I asked you now.
Yeah, no, I'm great.
Okay,
my health is good. My gander is up.
Your gander?
Or is it your dander?
I think you mean dander.
What's a gander?
Like male goose.
I'm a male goose.
Did you bring that goose in the house again?
No.
I told you to leave it outside.
I've noticed you've started blogging again, to change the subject. We were speaking about this before. You've started saying things on your blog.
I've started saying Yes, I've started saying things on my blog.
Some of them are feminist.
Yeah, well, that happens quite regularly.
So we can expect this routinely now?
Yeah, I never meant to take that long a break. I just meant to have about 3 months off to finish a book, and then it just became more and more, and I just kind of, fell off the blog
wagon.
Who
keeps internet tabs open on their computer like day after day? Who does that?
Me.
Don't you turn the computer off?
Yeah, but when I turn it back on,
the tabs are there. The tabs are still there, yeah. So I'm glad you're blogging again because I think you're wonderful.
Oh, thank you.
And I've linked to a blog post of yours on my blog, which I thought was great, which was one of your opening blogs, if I'm not wrong.
One of my opening – reopening. Grand reopening.
Correct. About gender and being a good or bad feminist.
Yes.
But we won't talk about that now.
We won't talk about that.
I just wanted to mention that. But now there's feedback, correct?
We do, and I want to get to it. Straight off the bat, because otherwise we will end up talking about these two books for 3,000 hours and at the end we'll say, well, we didn't have time for feedback again. So we'll start with the feedback and then we'll do it.
I'm really...
That's my plan.
It's a good plan. How are you, by the way?
I'm fine.
Yeah, that's great. So who's this feedback from? I don't even remember it.
it was from a couple episodes ago. It was actually the episode where we were talking about the courier's new bicycle. And Mark Webb wrote into us, and I'll just read out part of his email because he was interested in us expanding on a point that we made. Where at the end of the podcast, or the end of the talking about that book, you were saying how you didn't put yourself squarely in the heads of characters who weren't
my gender,
your gender, and I said that I hadn't had that problem. So here's what Mark wrote in his email. Kirsten made the point that her formative reading experience forced her to develop the ability to be able to put yourself in the place of a much wider range of characters. I think it is fair to say that both of you agreed that this ability was a good thing, if not the situation that caused it. I would agree. However, you also make the point that young women girls today have a significantly wider range of strong female protagonists to choose from. Do you think this will result in a generation of women with the same inability to place themselves in an alternatively gendered protagonist skin that currently afflicts men of our generation? Or is there enough of a choice in characters to render the issue less relevant for future generations? So I thought we could...
That's an absolutely awesome question.
Isn't it? I think it's a really, really great question.
Probably deserve someone far more intelligent than me. You could answer it, but I think I'd... No, it's a really, really interesting thing.
It is. Well, it was a really... Well, I remember when we were talking about identifying with characters and different reading experiences... I remember thinking that's a really long discussion that could be a podcast on its own.
Yeah, almost. Absolutely.
So thank you, Mark, for writing in and saying that because it's kind of brought us back to the topic. I think in an ideal quote unquote world, or perhaps a, I don't know, a more diverse world, if all girls just read books about female characters and all boys just read books about boys, male characters, in a world that was, I guess, more diverse and more equal, yes, it probably would have that same effect. If you only read a particular type of protagonist, especially, I guess, a central narrating protagonist, I think you would have that effect. Unfortunately, I don't think the question is moot at the moment, but I don't think even if all girls read between the ages of, you know, 5 and 15 when they're, I guess, more picking books for themselves, if all they read were books about girls, if they could even find books just about girls to fill their
reading. I think they probably could.
Well, I don't know, because I found a lot of the books that will have a female protagonist, there will, at least in the genre books that I've been reading, to be fair, I don't read a lot of teen romance. There's genres I just don't read in, so I don't know about those books. But at least in the teenage / YA books that I have been reading, even when there's a female protagonist, she usually has male friends. It's not just a bunch of girls.
Are you saying the ones where the male was the protagonist is very rarely a girl?
Often.
Often it's
Hardy Boy stuff.
Okay.
You know, so it is a bunch of boys.
Okay, fine.
But even if all girls read were female protagonists and characters, female characters with agency, and the boys were kind of on the outskirts and so on. In the current way the world works, I don't think that's going to make any difference, because it's not just the literature, it's everything. It's everything in the world. Everything is default male. So I think that actually supports the literature rather than the other way around. So it wasn't just that you were reading a whole bunch of books, Ian, about boys, and so therefore you never identified with your characters. Oh, you're saying
there's many stimulus points, one of which was books.
The whole societal structure is there to for the human being as a default model to be male.
Yeah,
okay. I mean, that's really what it is. So even girls who don't read grow up in a world where the default is male. Simple as that.
Yep.
And we're taught to identify from a very, very young age that, you know, the default male is actually meant to be all of us, except it's not. I mean, the iconography is male. Until recently, the pronouns that we used were male, and we're girls and women are kind of meant to slot ourselves in there invisibly and say, you know, when you read when you read something and they say he said, and it's not a specific person, they're just talking about a person in general, and it's he and his, and you're meant to just slot yourself in there, and it's just something you just talk.
So we're wired to have.
Well, we're
that
not
sort
wired.
Of...
We're socialised.
Yes. Okay. Good point.
I think male,
and that's happening today, even for the generation.
Oh,
the 15-year-olds of today.
It is. I thought, okay, well, here's a really – because I was thinking about this the other day. Again, thank you. Thank you, Mark. It's actually made me really think about this question, because it's much wider than books. But at the most basic level, when you're crossing a street, what do you see on the pedestrian lights?
A little man.
Yeah, but they're not meant to be little man.
No.
Right? It's not just men cross here, women find another way to go.
You're saying because it does – well, no, it does. Is it a man? It doesn't have boobs.
This is the interesting thing, though.
It doesn't have boobs.
Okay, so this is radio, and I'm going to do something visual, but I'll describe what I am doing to the listeners.
Is this one of these weird experiments that
No. So what I'm doing here is I'm just drawing your standard ideogram when it comes to drawing a person, right?
Yes.
So I'm drawing a circle.
Yes.
And below the circle, I'm drawing a vertical
line. I can confirm you're doing these things.
And then I'm drawing like two angular lines coming off the bottom of that vertical line, and then another two coming off, you know, down from about where the shoulders would be. Right? So if I showed that ideogram to you.
Or your traditional stick figure.
But if I showed that ideogram to you, that would be.
It's, well, you think it's a man.
It's a person,
but your default to it's got no boobies.
but why is that male?
Well, it's not male, but
you exactly.
Just...
But why? But seriously, I mean, I agree with you. This is what you know. And if you're going to draw a female stick figure, we'd put a skirt on her or something,
or
right?
Boobies. Or I keep coming back to boobies. But no, it's true though. Because
but why? Seriously, look at that figure. Why is it male? What is it? If you forget everything you've been taught, why is that symbol male?
It's not. It's at not. All. Absolutely not.
It's absolutely not. And at some point, we've decided that this figure, which is actually just a bipedal creature.
Yes.
I mean, it's not even mammal, right? It's a bipedal creature that we have decided means human being. And at some point we've decided that figure, which means human being, actually means male.
Yeah, okay.
Human being. And in order to get an accompanying figure, if we want to actually specify between genders, we have to do something to this figure. We don't get two more. We don't say, okay, well, male's going to be, oh, I'll draw another little, like, long thing hanging down between the legs and that will mean male.
That was really disturbing. You just did then. And you coloured it
but
in.
Can you imagine if, like, listeners, I've drawn a little, another vertical line.
It's called a penis. You've drawn a coloured penis.
Well, it's just pen.
Okay.
But this is the thing, like, wouldn't that figure, maybe I'll put these up, I'll scan this and put this
up. It looks like a bit of its intestines has fallen off it. No, because you wouldn't.
If you're going to adjust this basic stick figure to mean male, wouldn't actually that make more
yes,
sense?
Yes, you'd have to put a scrotum sack on it.
We don't have to get too anatomically
okay.
correct.
But the point is, yes, you're right. Whereas you're right. So what you're saying is if you're going to draw two people,
yeah,
one a man and one a woman, the man would just be what you've drawn without the scrotum.
Exactly,
penis.
Our traditional stick figure, which is deemed to be
male. And the woman
male.
Would have a dress
The
or
woman will have
something.
A dress. Sometimes they put long hair.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, it's when you go into to
yes.
toilets, you know, the male-female sign. If it's not one of these, I mean, you do get some that are quite different now, but if it's just your basic stick figure, they're the same, except with the woman, they've given her some sort of a dress or a skirt.
It's amazing. You're 100% correct. I've never even thought of that.
Which is a really westernised culture thing anyway.
I can't believe toilets are so sexist. No, but you're right.
But
no, I'm taking
like,
a piss, but you're 100% right.
I went into the one, and this is the thing. Once you see this thing, you can't unsee this thing. I went into the toilets at the airport a couple months ago, and they were cleaning. So
yes.
They had a sign up
yes.
telling you they were cleaning and,
yes.
and the floor was slippery. And they had and going into the female toilets at the airport, they had a stick figure there slipping over in water. And it's the male stick figure, except it's not. It's just a human stick finger. But we're so, you know, this is what human is.
Did you ring up the airport there, you know, head office and complain?
No, but I mean, my point is
I know
that,
what you're, I'm being a
that
dick. I know
humans
what you're
as default male is how girls are raised to view the world. We are raised to view ourselves as a subset.
So getting back to the point of
Mark's
feedback,
yeah.
What you're arguing is that the preponderance or the additional amount of books written by not written by women but featuring female protagonists won't be enough to mitigate the default that exists at the moment, which is male.
No,
it won't even touch the surface.
It will touch the surface.
Well, if it's going to do anything, it'll be the opposite. It'll have men of that generation, unlike mine, be able to identify more with women.
I'd hope so. I'd hope that, which is why it always gets me so, you know, depending on my mood, sometimes really sad, sometimes just furious when I see anyone writing articles and blog entries about how, you know, we must write boy books for boys to get them reading. And there is a problem with young men reading.
Yes.
Books,
yes.
I may say, not reading other things, and maybe we're preferencing one type of...
Wait, like what? Like not reading comics?
Comics, narratives in video games. Sorry, that's showing my age, computer games. I mean, to say that boys don't read is not... You know, they're not reading a particular type of text, but to say that they're not using... that.
Yeah, okay, I get it.
To say that they're not interacting with narrative and interrogating narrative and having narrative in their life is not true.
Yep.
But in any case, if we're talking about books boys actually reading books and novels and things like that, I don't think the answer is to say, oh, well, they're not reading now, so we must just write books about boys that boys will like because they can't possibly read a book about a girl and actually think that's fun. I think that's really dangerous.
Yeah, and there was that argument a couple of years back about there are too many books with female protagonists and we're missing out a whole generation of boys.
There aren't, just by the way.
You've done figures?
I haven't done figures, but I've
the internet has.
The internet has. I mean, again, in certain genres they are. Like teen romance, overwhelmingly about girls. Absolutely.
But that was around back in the day. Babysitter's Club's been around since I was a kid. I mean, it's always been around.
Of course.
Did you ever read it?
My middle sister loved The Babysitter's Club and Sweet Valley High, I think.
Yeah, that was around
too.
Yeah,
with the two blonde twins, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you remember when you used to
each week or each month at school you'd get the Scholastic.
I loved Scholastic Reading Club.
That's right. I loved it too.
Yeah.
And Sweet Valley Shitter's Ditch was throughout that whole thing and Babysitter's Club
and all
that.
I don't remember that too much.
Yeah, well, it was.
Okay.
But you had to flick through it because it had younger kids.
I remember always, like, they would come out every month and I'd make my mum buy me any book that had a pony in it any book that had a dragon in it. And then as I got older, any book that was about space.
Or princesses. Is that what you said?
Yeah, like fantasy princesses and
in space.
Elves. And,
did they have to be in space?
No. Well, that would have been cool. I don't think I ever had a book about a princess in space. Maybe I'll write one.
Well, technically, Princess of Mars is Edgar Rice Burroughs is a princess.
Anyway, moving on. But this is my point is that I think it's great that there's so many YA books out there with young girls as the protagonists, or just young girls as part of a circle of friends. So I think having those books there is wonderful, and I hope that boys are reading those books as well as girls, which I think a lot of boys are. It probably helps that there is often mixed genders and sexualities in a circle of friends in a lot of YA books, and it's not just, you know, five girls running around doing girl things.
Yeah.
I think the wider society kind of overrides that in every significant sense.
So basically, if you had to give a one-line answer to Mark after speaking about this for 2 or 3 hours, you would say we're all fucked. No, you'd say that a book is only one data point, reading is only one data point, there are many other data points, and the female protagonists in books will not mitigate the other data points, and the default that is
men. It will help to mitigate, but it's not going to completely overrule it. No, because, I mean, you just have to have a look at our culture and the visual elements in our culture, the way women are portrayed, the very, very, very narrow scope in which, you know, physically and emotionally and so on, you are allowed to be a woman. As opposed to the much greater scope that men have.
Yep.
That
stick figure thing is going to live with me the rest of my life. Especially the penis you drew. That was.
Well, if you're going to gender that ideogram, and you're going to say that ideogram is male, you got to gender that.
Okay.
So but we don't.
Is that a cisgendered stick figure? I'm trying to get used to using the word cis.
Yeah. I don't know how that stick figure feels about him or herself.
Oh, it's about their own feelings and their own sexuality. So it's only if it's a heterosexual stick figure with.
Well, not heterosexual, but if that stick figure that I have clearly drawn a penis on thinks he's a man, then that is a 100% male stick figure.
There's never been this discussion in the history of mankind. There's never been this discussion, I promise you. Never.
So there's something to think about next time you cross the street.
Yes, that's exactly the moral of the story. So
I think we'll move on from terrorising Ian with anatomically correct.
It was a really nice picture. I love how you drew the circle
too.
Yeah, man, thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Mark, for making us think again.
And people, once again, as much feedback as possible.
Yeah.
Because we won't ignore it, mostly.
Okay, the first book we're going to talk about this month is The Night Circus by Erin Morgenstern, which was my recommendation for the podcast, which, small confession, listeners, I recommended without reading first.
Yeah, has a go at me about this all the time.
Yes, now.
I've not done it a lot.
You've done it more than I have.
Yes, and I've done it for an upcoming podcast already, but it's not my fault because I had to recommend a book before I had time to have read it. So, but anyway, yes, go ahead.
So I, yes, but I did really like the book, so that was good. I would have been the worst thing to recommend it and then read it and go, oh no.
Well, did you love it though?
I did.
Unreservedly?
Not unreservedly. We don't have to love things unreservedly nominate them. No, I did. Actually, it's funny because, I mean, you're here and you can see this book.
Yes, it's gorgeous.
It is a gorgeous book. It's because I'd heard a lot about The Night Circus. It was kind of on my list of, I should maybe think about reading that. It sounds kind of interesting, sort of list of books in my head. I think it might have been on my book depository wish list or something even, you know. And then I walked into my local bookshop and they had a pile of these books sitting there right at the front of the shop. And for anyone who has not seen the hardcover of The Night Circus, it is a beautiful book. The edges of the pages are black for a start. The pages aren't. That would have been awesome if it was white print on black paper. Like when I opened it, a little part of me did die.
I could have done that
when it was print on
the
white.
Kindle version, I could have done that if I wanted to.
That would...
But except my eyes would have melted.
Yeah, eyes would have melted. But the edges are black. The hardcover itself is red, and it's got
the bowler hat.
It's yeah. The end papers have the hats that are a motif in the book. It's got a beautiful satiny ribbon. It's just the most gorgeous artifact. And I have to confess, that's what made me buy it there and then. Like I wouldn't have bought it if it hadn't been a book I was already quasi-interested in, but it was like, no, I must have that book right now.
I've got the Kindle version, which I'm not upset about. And
not at all. Look at my pretty book.
But I'm now – well, yes, okay, you've made your point. I'm saying I'm not upset having the Kindle version, but it doesn't compare. I mean, and it comes back to this whole Kindle versus hard copy, e-book versus hard copy argument. Ultimately, if you love the book, the artifact of the book itself is – Worth the extra cash.
You know, I'm on both sides of the fence. I do love books as artifacts, but I wouldn't keep a really beautiful, a physically beautiful book if I didn't like the book. There'd be no the point to it. But books that I really, really like, I'm quite happy to have a gorgeous edition of. So why are you flicking through the book? It is white paper.
No, I know. I'm just feeling the texture. It's just beautiful.
It is. It's a really, really beautiful.
I wanted to see if the black would it rub off. It doesn't. I used spit and everything, and it didn't get rid of it.
It's disgusting.
Yes. Anyway, so for those people who are for some reason still listening to us, even though they haven't read the book, do you want to give them a few plot points?
Yeah, well, I guess I can do what we usually do in these situations, and I can read the copy that the publishers have so nicely given us here. In 1886, a mysterious travelling circus becomes an international sensation. Open only at night, constructed entirely in black and white, Le Cirque du Rêve delights all who wander its circular paths and warm themselves at its bonfire. Oh, the bonfire.
The bonfire is pretty cool.
Yeah. Although there are acrobats, fortune tellers and contortionists, the circus of dreams is no conventional spectacle. Some tents contain clouds, some ice. The circus seems almost to cast a spell over its aficionados, who call themselves the rêveurs, the dreamers. At the heart of the story is the tangled relationship between two young magicians, Celia, the enchanter's daughter, and Marco, the sorcerer's apprentice. At the behest of their shadowy masters, they find themselves locked in a deadly contest, forced to test the very limits of their imagination and of their love. It's actually not the greatest copy I've read, really, because it gives a little bit away there.
Yeah, and the one on the Kindle, which is actually within the book itself, doesn't do the book
Mind
justice
you, as
either.
Soon as you've got these two characters on stage, you know that this is going to become a love story. I think giving that away is not it's very obvious that that's where that's going to go.
It's actually – there is a predictability to the book, let's be honest.
There is.
It hits a certain – groove and doesn't go off that groove.
Yeah, but it's not the kind of book that's meant to be having twists and turns.
Well, I don't know. I don't know if that's entirely right because I think she is trying to surprise you on some level. I mean, it is a circus and circuses are about enigmas and mysteries and things like that.
Yeah.
So I think she is trying to capture that idea, but the actual storytelling is very well. I know. I say that she's very smart, though. In my opinion, Morgenstern, she seems to understand that she's got this star-crossed lover thing happening between Celia and Marco, and that really can only go in one basic direction. Also, well, you mentioned the contest then, did you? No.
Yeah, yeah, okay. the contest between the two.
Celia's father and Marco's, what would you call him?
Well, he becomes his guardian.
Yeah, guardian.
Mr. A.H., as he's known throughout the book.
Basically, or Alexander.
Basically goes to an orphanage and plucks a young orphan boy from the orphanage to train up to be his contestant. As part of the challenge.
And the challenge is that the two will not fight each other, but
it's never really clear what the challenge is. It's clear at the end.
Well, I don't think it is. I don't think it is clear at the end.
I think it's clear.
it's two types of magic. Which magic is better than the other type? But I don't.
The idea is well it's not two types of magic. It's because the idea is that it's not. It's that old thing that magic isn't magic per se. It's merely learning how to manipulate the world in a way that most people don't know how to manipulate the world. So you know, it's like discovering a different set of laws of physics that you then know how to use that most people don't. And so the challenge between the two, I guess, older magicians are whether this ability is stronger when it's manifested, I guess, naturally through genetics,
or whether
it's something that you can pretty much, you know, as happens, you can just pluck anyone from anywhere who's got the most rudimentary affinity and teach them via spells, via actual study.
But I also got the feeling throughout that this is a chaos versus order test as well, because it starts, because it's quite clear that Prospero, which is not his real name, Hector Bowen, who is Celia's father, was taught by Mr. A.H. or Alexander.
Yeah.
And also it felt that, like most students, felt he could do better than his teacher and thought that magic should be something that is used more widely and readily than Alexander.
Less confined to...
Yeah, who was about subtlety and keeping it nice and narrow. And
yes.
Yeah, and there's that element in it as well.
Yeah, I think...
Because Alexander sort of is uncomfortable by the fact that the whole thing's in a circus.
He is. He's uncomfortable about the public facet of the contest, because we're not told how. This is not the first contest they've had. They've had many. Like they're very old.
They're centuries. You've seen these characters before in many other books.
Yes,
the enigmatic, and they're always men. Always often men.
Usually,
yes, enigmatic, ancient sort of people who play with the lives of us mere
mortals. It kind of goes back to sort of, you know, God and the the antagonist, really.
But I'm just saying it's not an original concept.
No. Morgenstern. You know, it is puppetry, I guess, in a way. And I guess the difference about this contest that the book is about is that for the first time, one of the contestants is the daughter of Hector.
Yep.
She's not just someone who he's found who has this innate talent who he's then teaching and fostering, which is why he thinks she'll actually win this time, because she's his daughter.
Yep.
She must be better than anyone else. But I think by the end of the book, not necessarily the rules of the contest are laid down, because they're never laid down. You just kind of get the feeling that this contest is – well, I mean, it's a fight to the death.
Kirsten.
What?
First off – it shat me that the two main characters never figured out it was a fight to the death. The moment they say the word contest in this book, you know it's a fight to the death. It's clear from the first 10 pages this has got to be a fight to the death. I mean, what else is it going to be? And yet you've got Marco and Celia, who are very smart because they've got to be to know magic, who walk around and they don't even know that they're fighting against each other to begin with, but still are...
They're not told who their opponent is. There is an opponent somewhere.
And they do figure it out because they're smart. They're smart. Of course they're going to figure it out. But they never figure out the most obvious thing, that this is all going to end in tears. I mean, what else did they think it was going to end in? They're naive and stupid, and it didn't make... That was the one thing that shat me about the book, that there was something really naive about them, isn't that cute and clever sort of way.
There's a naivety about the whole book, in a sense, which maybe goes back to the writing style, which is, I guess, evoking that...
You didn't let me finish my point from 10 minutes ago.
Finish from 10 minutes ago.
Well, I was saying that the clever thing that she does.
Yeah, oh, yes. Oh, that
is that it's pretty obvious that this is all going to end in death and tears and shit. And that's the chart that Celia and Marco are moving in.
Mm-hmm.
So what she does is that she introduces the character of Bailey and Poppet and Widget.
Yep.
And runs these two non-linear, they're a different time. The Celia Marco story sort of starts around 1870. The Bailey Poppet story starts around 1897 to 1902. And they finally do all come and connect together.
They do.
But that story isn't obvious. That's the one story you're not sure where that's going to go and how it's going to connect to the main thread. And that's, in fact, it became that I didn't give a shit about Celia Marco. By the halfway novel, I actually did not care about them anymore. All I wanted to read about was Bailey and Poppet. That really worked for me.
Yeah, I didn't much care about the relationship between Celia and Marco either. Funnily enough, for a book which I guess is going along this star-crossed lovers path, but I don't think that's the heart of the book. That's not the central concern of the book.
Isn't it?
No, I don't think it is. I think
This theme's about doubles throughout it and all these lovely little thematic tricks, you know, twins and doubling up good versus evil, dark versus light, blah, 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 all that stuff. But what do you think the main thrust? Do you hear that microphone? what did you think the main thrust was?
I think the main thrust is the circus. I mean, that's it. The circus is the book.
Oh yeah, it becomes.
That's it. The circus and in a very real way, the book itself is like the circus. There's a lot of set pieces. It's almost like reading this book, especially the way it's been structured with the two stories that sort of pass each other in the night, to speak, and so on. It feels very much like some of the descriptions of the circus where you're walking into a tent and you stay there for a bit and you look at what's there and then you walk out and you walk into another tent and you're there now and then you look at what's there. And so you kind of wander through this book and it absolutely is a series of set pieces in a way.
Yeah, it is. It's fragmentary in that sense.
And I read I did a little bit of reading on the author's website and she was saying she began the book in NaNoWriMo.
Oh, really?
Which is really cool.
This is a NaNoWriMo book.
No, it's not a NaNoWriMo book. She wrote parts of the book over two Novembers of NaNoWriMo, which you're not meant to do, by the way. It's very naughty.
So, Erin.
and what she had at the end of those two Novembers wasn't anything. I mean, Celia, the character, wasn't even in the first draft. So it's quite a different book. It wasn't even a book. It was a collection of writing.
Okay.
And then she did a lot of work, obviously, to actually turn what she'd written during NaNoWriMo, two NaNoWriMos, into.
So, in a sense, a lot of short stories of different
tenses? A lot of vignettes and things, I guess. I don't know exactly what the first lot of writing looked like. But it definitely was written. And I got the impression she intended to make it a lot less linear because the two stories, even though it swaps back and forth between them and they're ahead and behind each other, the two stories themselves run pretty much straight down the line.
Yes, they themselves are linear, yeah.
So, and I think I got the impression she might originally have wanted to mess that around a little more, which would have been really interesting.
Yeah, but I don't see what the point of that would have been.
Yeah, I think having the two stories disjointed.
Unless there's a really good reason for it, it just always seems like an author who knows he or she has got a linear story.
You did Default Mail, didn't you?
Fucking hell.
And we're even talking about a female author's book.
She who, I'm thinking, anyway.
Whatever. Anyway.
He or she.
Yeah, we really need a gender neutral pronoun in English.
Can I
continue
the thought?
Continue, yes.
Thank you. He or she knows that it's very linear, so then thinks, well, what's a way of surprising people? I'll put everything out of order.
I'm not sure that's how authors write books either.
Well, maybe you don't, but I do get that feeling sometimes when you read a non-linear book that it's not for any reason integral to the story. It's just done for
a
laugh.
No, I think... I know, I'll just throw my chapters up in the air and wherever they land, that's how it's going to the publisher.
I get that feeling sometimes.
I think what we can say is that sometimes it doesn't work. I think I'm sure there are exceptions.
No, you can say that. I can say whatever the hell I like. No, okay, fine. All right.
There are possibly exceptions, but I don't think any author just randomly decides to mess around with wherever they put their stuff.
Okay,
I think they always have a reason. Whether they're able to execute that or whether it was necessary is another thing.
Sorry. Okay. No. That's. I'm glad you put me down on that and you schooled me. I did fall in love with the book to begin with, and I did like Celia Marco to begin with.
And then you just got,
but then
bored or
bored of them.
Bored of them.
Although not so bored that I couldn't finish the book or I didn't want to. I still wanted to read about it, and there was still interest. I really liked Chandresh, the magician, and I loved the twin sisters. They're not twins, actually, are they? Yeah, they're just very similar. Lainey and
The two sisters. They're not twins, but they look similar. Very much alike and dress
and,
alike.
And Tanta Padva and that.
Yeah, it's quite a
great set of characters in there, and that bring the
and the clockmaker.
That's what saved the Celia Marco.
The clockmaker was just
the Celia Marco story. Stuff with the clockmaker.
Yeah,
who sets up? Who inadvertently sets up this whole society around the circus? I'm not going to pronounce. What is it, the Cirque de Rêves?
Le Cirque de Rêves.
Yeah, can keep saying it.
Which just means the Circus of Dreams.
Yeah, so this is Clockmaker, who makes a clock that sits at the front of the circus, who doesn't know why he's making the clock, but he makes it for the architect who's involved in the construction of the circus. Then sort of he accidentally hears about the circus in Munich or something, goes and sees his clock and goes, ah-ha-ha! And it's an amazing clock, apparently, and it's beautifully described.
Yeah.
In fact, it's a lot of that – gorgeous writing from Morgenstern, and then starts to go and falls in love with the circus, starts to go all the time, and starts writing about his experiences, which gets published, and then he gets letters, which he writes back. A club is formed.
It's kind of like a fanzine.
Exactly, it's like a fanzine. Yes, he would win best fan writer for the Hugos.
He would,
for his stuff on the circus.
About the circus,
definitely. And then Celia, who falls in love with his words, starts writing to him.
Yeah.
And there's sort of the hint, not hint, but sort of this feeling that there's more than just there's something to this relationship. And if Marco had not been around, even though he's an older man, not young.
See, I thought it was more a father-daughter thing.
See, but we thought you were.
Yeah, I know, but the characters can think that. But I think from what we see of how they interact, I think for Celia it's more finding a much better father figure, who, to be honest with Hector, you don't have to go far to find a better father figure.
Hector's pretty evil, but he's a bit cardboard cutout evil. Not that he does much. I mean, he fades away
into nothing. Yeah,
throughout the novel. So it's he's not a big presence, but that saves the book. The Bailey Poppet stuff,
mm-hmm.
and the clockmaker and Celia stuff is what saves the book and keeps the momentum going.
Yeah.
And I would say Isabel, who's the fortune teller who Marco treats very poorly.
Yes. I didn't ever really like Marco.
No, Marco's
and I don't know whether
a dick.
I mean, he wasn't – to be fair, I don't think he was given as much enigma and charm as some of the other characters had. I think he was written – which may be a reflection of his master and the way he was taught and brought up, but I never had a hell of a lot of time for Marco. It was like whenever it was one of his point of view chapters, it was like hurry along.
And Abigail Nussbaum, who writes a really good review for Strange Horizons about both this book and Mechanique, which she does the two circus books together.
I want to read Mechanique.
Yeah, we should get to that one day.
Maybe we will. Have you seen my To Be Read piles?
Yeah, I think isn't it there? Yeah.
No, I haven't bought that one yet.
Okay, well, so she says, Abigail says that there's a sense of weightlessness to the characters, and that in fact she says that this includes Celia and Marco, who are little more than placeholders in a generic star-crossed lover's plot.
Yeah,
which is they are after a while they stop being characters and they just are ciphers.
Yeah,
and that's why Bailey because Abigail wasn't that convinced by Bailey and Poppet either. But to me, they are great. They are genuine characters. Bailey comes off as a genuine three-dimensional character.
I think it's –
I haven't explained who Bailey is, have I?
Well, Bailey's the boy who's the central character of that subplot.
Yes.
That runs –
He's a boy who wants to run away
to join the circus.
Yeah, he basically wants to run and becomes quite important to the circus.
Yeah. I think this is one of those books that – and I know there's like not everyone – reads in this way, but and I think I've said this on previous episodes, I will get as much enjoyment out of the way a book is written than as well as the way the characters are drawn and the story is developed. I mean, I can't sit and read however many pages this is,
387
pages of beautiful prose if there is no story to carry it, if, you know, if the characters are just nothing. I mean, yeah. There has to be some substance to the work other than the style and the way it's written. But, I mean, it is a very real pleasure for me, the way words are put together. So I got a lot of enjoyment out of this book simply by the way it was crafted.
But it's very understated, the writing. There's no melodrama in this book. There is in the dialogue, but not in the way the descriptions.
No.
There were some lines I highlighted in my Kindle.
I think you misunderstand when I say that, you know, the style doesn't mean baroqueness and overwroughtness and stuff like that. I mean, style is anything. Style is the way James Ellroy writes.
I'm not an idiot.
But that's what I'm saying. So. I mean, I think this book was very well crafted from a style point of view, and the writing is really beautiful. And sometimes it's really simple and clean, and sometimes it's a little more poetic. But I think
I expected to be though, really nice. Considering it's about a circus, I expected to be more pyrotechnical and baroque and full of curlicues and the like. But it isn't.
No, it isn't. I think that would have been. I think if it was written in that way, it would have not worked because the. What she's describing something that is baroque and over the top. But in order to get the full weight of that across to you, I think she has to use very clean language
It'd be difficult, though, to do the whole sense of wonder thing and do it in the way she's written it. But you're right, she pulls it off.
Yeah. But, I mean, I think...
that's the craft you're talking about.
And that's the craft I'm talking about.
Okay.
And I think...
The penny drop.
And that's what I mean. I think it is a beautifully written book, and I do think the writing is beautiful. It doesn't have to be, you know, heavy with metaphors and beautiful similes.
What about
and all
POV
that sort of
changes?
Stuff.
It's got POV changes.
But
no, I don't mean. But in the same section,
yeah. But here's the thing. Here's the thing.
Here we go.
No, because I've had this conversation with other people recently too.
It's your biggest bugbear.
Yeah. No. Okay. I'm going to say this.
I know. I'll shut up now. You go.
Because I think I've worked out a way to articulate exactly what is important about POV, point of view, for people who don't know the abbreviation. The point of view of a book is what grounds the reader. Right? The reader reads the book through the point of view that's presented.
Okay.
Now, in a book where you have very, very immersive character points of view, which these days is a lot of books. You have very immersive point of view to the point where with a lot of books, a lot of the way I write, I could substitute third person for first person and there would not need to be much editing made, except, of course, when you do first person, you have to actually really tone down the language.
What do you mean? The swearing? Or
No. It's an interesting thing. You can get away – some tips of the trade here, people. You can get away with
– Free of charge.
Revealing all my secrets. You can get away with a lot more in terms of, I guess, things that would seem a bit melodramatic if they were written in first person. They don't when you write them in third person. And even though you have a really immersive point of view, because it is still third person, because it's not a character saying, I think this, I do this, it is still a third person, even though for all practical purposes it is entirely and utterly their point of view. You can get away with a little more.
What I want you to do in the show notes is to put two examples of that up. I'm joking.
Okay. Anyway, so you can have a really, really, really immersive character point of view, which at its most extreme is a first-person point of view.
Yep.
That's it, just inside that character's head. You can pull out of that a little and you become a very immersive third-person point of view. Essentially still should be everything and only things that a character can know, see, hear,
gotcha.
And so on. You pull back out further and you get what's called the omniscient point of view,
yep.
which is where you can have knowledge from different characters and even from outside of the book. So Tolkien's a really good example of that, where you have any story that has a very clear narrator telling you a story.
But most of the stories told around the fire are omniscient third person.
Yeah, because it's – I mean, fairy tales are omniscient fairy tales point are all, of view.
Yeah.
You know. So anyway – point of view is what grounds the reader in the book. If you do not have a solid point of view, it's really easy to get lost in the book. Now, what's a really tricky point of view to write, and I think Morgenstern does it beautifully, is when you have – if you think about the omniscient narrator, which this book does not have a really explicit omniscient narrator.
No, it doesn't.
In the sense of you've got someone standing behind you going, oh, and by the way, here's what's happening.
Yeah, because it's not a book that has lots of little bits of foreshadowing in it.
No, it doesn't. But her narrative voice is so cohesive that the narrative voice of this book is a character in itself. And if you're going to write a book where you are switching point of view between characters...
In the same scene.
In the same scene... Your narrative voice has to be so strong and so grounded and so cohesive that that is the line that the reader is drawn along. The reader is not deep inside the head of Celia or Marco or any other character, even if certain scenes are written from their point of view, that the narrating voice itself is an invisible character. And you don't even – I mean, Stephen King's a perfect example of that. It is – and it's – we often talk about the voice of the author. It's not the voice of the author. It's the narrating voice of the book. And it doesn't have to be an explicit narrator. But if you're going to switch point of view, and the Kathy Koja book that we read last year, Under the Poppy.
Yeah, does it as well. Yeah.
And it had with that book was amazing, the way she would literally, you felt an almost physical pull.
Yes, that's right.
She drew you through characters because there was such a strong narrating voice in that book that you can do that. And where it really irritates me is when the authors haven't done that. So they've just got immersive third person point of view and then they'll switch to another character and you do not have this governing voice of the book, which is where the reader is.
Okay, and you just said it there, the governing voice of the book. That's the key message.
There you go.
That's beautifully said.
And that's it.
So I never thought you always do this to me. I'd never thought of it that way. And each time I – because I don't have as much of a problem with it, but I always think of you when I see point of view changes in the scene. But you're right, because of the way – and you're right, absolutely, this book takes you on a journey and the cohesive governing narrative voice.
Yeah.
It does that, it pulls you along, and you don't feel, oh my God, I just swat. No. I did think it because I thought of you, but I did that once and then I stopped.
Kirsten, we're like this. I was like, no, but that's
it. That was it. I stopped thinking that because I just got taken along, and you're right, the Kathy Koja one's another.
Yeah. So you have this voice of the book, which is what is dragging on. So even when you have scenes from the point of view of characters, you're not inside their head looking through their eyes.
And to be fair, she doesn't do it a lot. It does happen, but it's not constant.
But I mean, the voice of the book itself is, I think, just beautiful. It's a very confident voice. It's a voice I think you feel very safe as a reader with. You feel that the book has purpose, and even when if there's a part where you're not sure about that's confusing, you haven't put the pieces together, you still have confidence as a reader that the book has cohesion.
You're right. It's clarity. It's clean. You're 100% right. That's why when you start it, even if you're not that pressed with Marco and Celia and feel that they're not, well, as Abigail Nussbaum says, placeholders, the momentum of the book will take you – because that governing voice will pull you through anyway.
And I think the imagination that surrounds the circus is such a magnificent creation. There is a studio that's optioned the film rights.
Oh, yeah, I was going to ask you that. There has been?
It's just been optioned. And part of me, like, I don't want to see the movie.
But you could see Tim Burton doing this. This has got Tim Burton written all over it.
Maybe it's a bit controlled for Tim Burton.
You think so?
Maybe.
Because there really is that sense of magic, and magic, about the circus, and that sense of the impossible just happening.
I can see this
regularly
being done well. I can see it more easily being done badly with just over the top
CGI
and making it just a spectacle with no heart. It's all just about let's just make these beautiful, amazing things.
Yeah, I suppose but you're right. Yeah.
If you didn't have the people in this book, if you just did have a series of vignettes about circus tents and what happened at the circus, I mean, I don't think you'd get through 380 odd pages.
Yeah, I agreed.
But yeah, no, I really did enjoy the book, and it's one that I'm
still trying to figure out how the train worked.
Well, it's magic. Everything was magic. I was so wanted to go to this circus.
Yeah,
I'd definitely go this circus.
Yeah, well, look, I recommend it with reservations, and they being that I didn't engage as closely with the two main characters. But Bailey, I fell in love with Bailey. I'm Poppet. Adored Poppet.
Yeah, Poppet was great.
Poppet is great. Bailey and Poppet together. Look, Bailey's a bit of a wet. What's the word I'm looking for? Wet thingamajig.
I don't know what you're saying.
I was going to say wet nurse, but that didn't work. I don't know why I would have said.
Did you say wet nurse?
I don't know why wet nurse went through my head. Huh. He's wet behind the ears. He's a bit.
Okay. He's a bit gormless.
Yeah, a bit gormless.
To begin with. I think he grows unexpectedly.
He does, actually. But he's unexpectedly cruel to his sister, which I didn't like. He calls her insipid and things like that when he's leaving. I didn't get that from Morganson, why she did that to Bailey's sister. Why, there's some little bits I just didn't understand.
You've got a sister.
Yeah. I wouldn't call her insipid, though.
No, but...
And knowing that I'm leaving, I'm going off to the circus never to be seen again, the last things I'm saying...
She was pretty nasty to him.
I mean, okay, a bit of a self-obsessed girl.
I thought the sibling rivalry thing was actually done quite well. And, I mean, I think this is what a boy like Bailey would think about his older sister.
Yeah,
Who thought the circus was stupid and thought he was stupid for liking the circus.
I was fantasizing that I was Bailey. I don't know. That's probably what it was. Because there's that relationship with Poppet, and I really got caught up with that sizzle between and that a subdued sizzle between the two where you know that they're into each other but they just can't exactly
and
say
when
it
he, and I'm not going to spoil the ending, but when he goes back to the circus that night,
yes,
and what, oh, you just go, no,
yes I went, it's, no, yeah. I said, why are you doing this?
I know,
this,
it's like, no,
stop doing
that. don't do that
that's terrible.
It's a good book. It doesn't, for a book which seems like, I think we've been talking about it as though it's just really nice and it goes along this path. there's a lot of, she pulls a lot of things out of hats to use a
magic metaphor.
Yeah,
we haven't talked about the thematic stuff, which
We did. You started talking about doubles and things. And, but, I mean, she does, there's some bad stuff that happens in this book.
It's not just
a nice, fun time at the circus. It's
some shocking stuff. Not violently shocking, just but just
horrible.
Shocking.
Really, like, genuinely horrible. And you just, like, about characters you care about. And, I think it's a really – the book has a lot more depth, I think, than some reviews I've read seem to give it credit for.
Did you read the Abigail Nussbaum one?
Hadn't come across that one.
Should we link that to the show notes?
We can link that in the show notes.
Okay.
I usually do. I usually link reviews we've actually mentioned. But yeah, like the reviews I kind of read, they seem to waver between absolutely, you know, like jumping up and down, excited puppy reviews about how brilliant and masterful the book was, and it's just amazing, and you'll love it, and blah 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 blah. And reviews that kind of went, well, it's a first novel. It's not too bad. It's about a circus. I'm sure she'll do better. Seriously, there was kind of like these two extremes. And I think
– bit like the book, duality.
I don't think it's a masterpiece. I think it's an extraordinary good book from a stylist point of view. I'm really keen to read – what she does next in her career. I think she's a really good writer. What she does next is not going to be a circus book, which I think is great.
What is she doing next?
She said something on her website about like
spaceships.
Surrealist Alice in Wonderland. I know I'm misquoting. I'm not going to say it.
Well, you said half of it, Surrealist Alice in Wonderland.
Yeah, but I don't think that's right. The point is, I don't think she's a writer who has. I hope she's not a writer who's just sort of lucked out and or is getting just in this, oh, I write circus things. Yeah, I think her writing is, yeah, I'm going to say unique. I think it actually is unique.
Okay, that's a big call. I wouldn't have said that. I just think it's very well crafted, now that you've convinced me that it's what that is.
But that's what I mean. I think the way this book has been put together, it's very possibly not unique. That you're right. That is a very big call. But it's quite different from the way a lot of books are written. And I think to hang so much on the craftsmanship of your book and you know, not to fall into a lot of the very easy ways of writing a book like this with a lot of melodrama and a lot of, yep, you know, hanging, you know, cliffhangers at the end of chapters and all that sort of stuff. Yep. But to have this beautifully crafted book, which is just, here you are, here's a book, read it.
Yeah, I agree. It wasn't.
I think that's
it didn't get on
different.
The orange list. It was long listed, but it didn't get on the final ballot.
Yeah, I'm not too surprised about that. I think
it's a better book than The Tiger's Wife, though.
I would definitely. And isn't that interesting? Because in a way, like when we were talking about The Tiger's Wife, that was also very much, it felt like a series of
vignettes.
Stories thrown together. Yeah. And I think The Night Circus has a similar feel, but it's much more cohesive.
Agreed. Agreed.
I think this is a way to write a book which is very heavily set piece based, but to do it in a way that, you know, you're still dragging the reader along. The reader's still interested in the next set piece and the next one and the next one. And
yeah, because you're right. You could excise some of these and just have them as short stories.
Yeah.
All right. Well, anything more?
No, I think I've said everything. really good book. Really enjoyed it. Quite highly.
So we're going to go from this to A Dead Man Who's White. I don't know why I've said that.
Such a bad segue.
It's the worst segue ever. We're going from Erin Morgenstern to George Alec Effinger.
Yes.
I don't mean to be offensive about George, because I chose this book. So
you
obviously,
did.
You know, I fell in love with this book when I first read it about a decade ago.
Oh, okay. Did you reread it?
Yes.
Okay, good.
Yes. Yeah, you told me very clearly after last year and some of my balls ups with a couple of books I recommended. The Shakespeare.
Is that what happened in that book?
Like, the Shakespeare one and the other one. Anyway, the Jack O'Connell book where I hadn't reread them and didn't have a fucking clue what was going on.
That was really funny, actually.
Still
like, is that what happened? Oh, yeah. Did he die? Oh, he did die at the end. What happened to the kid? Oh, that's right.
I'm saying this all on the podcast.
Awesome.
I said some of it before the podcast and during it. So anyway, so knowing that, I reread this before I gave it back to you.
That's cool because I'm really enjoying the ones we've done actually where we're discussing a reread book. Like I find that really interesting. I think a rereading can be well, it can, as we've found out, it can completely change your opinion of a book.
Yes, like World War X. World War Z. That's right.
Or it can just sort of deepen your appreciation of books. So, what happened with you?
Oh, I'll get to that in a sec. Okay. So, our friendly bookseller Justin Aykroyd gave me a
foisted it on you.
Beautiful, because I rebought this book from Advanced Book Exchange. That's this. We got a radio.
I can't find.
He gave me the beautiful hardcover of it. Gorgeous, the yellow cover. It's gorgeous. And I read it and fell in love with it, and I couldn't find it in the 20,000 boxes of books I've got. So I went to Advanced Book Exchange and bought a ratty paperback.
Where do you keep your books? I've been to your house.
No, they're not in the house.
Okay.
They're at Booran.
Okay, right.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Yeah. Do you want to hear more about that?
No, I was just wondering because I've been to your house. It's like I didn't see it stacked like a warehouse.
Yeah, they're in a cupboard. So I loved it. On rereading it, I still enjoyed it, but I saw a lot more plot issues with it. That said, what I found really interesting, well, we completely went over my head the first time I read it. Remember, gender 101 and all those sorts of issues. So, you know, reading about transgendered characters who play a role in this and all that sort of jazz, that wasn't what got me through the book. It was the noir stuff. That's what I really liked. This time around, the noir stuff actually started to irritate me, especially towards the end.
Yeah.
And what I really found interesting was the fact that he was doing all this stuff with both a religion that isn't his, a faith that isn't his, and obviously he's not a transgendered man. George Alec. Well, he's not.
He's okay.
No, he was a bloke. He was an actual, well, he was a bloke. I'm getting into gender, right, gender essentialism here that I'm gone already. So I'm stuffed. And I was thinking, as I'm reading this, I'm thinking this is actually quite an interesting book compared to Courier's new bike, in that mm-hmm. how they deal with those, the issue of transgendered and that.
Yeah.
Let's put this in context. This was written
1987.
So it's written in the middle towards the end of 2 years after Neuromancer.
Yep.
So it's written during the cyberpunk period. It is cyberpunk by more or less. People plug into stuff.
Yeah, I guess so. I don't know. I guess maybe it's
I think it is. I think
technopunk.
Yeah, okay. I don't think they had the term technopunk back then, because that's what this is considered, cyberpunk.
Yeah, I guess.
Effinger was someone who, and I don't know a lot about him. There are people in around who swear by him, Justin Ackroyd being one.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote, I think he went to Clarion in the early 70s. He wrote a number, so he started with Clarion.
Right.
The usual, published a lot of short stories, and then he started writing the Bodhiyin books.
Have you read the other two, which come
no,
this?
I own them again in boxes.
In boxes.
And I really don't want to.
Don't you wish you could just put your hands on those boxes and just osmose the books?
Because to be honest with you, after reading this, I did want to go back to read the – and I wanted to read the other two when I read it the first time, mm-hmm. and I still want to.
Yeah.
Bodhiyin. That's one of the short – there's a short story collection from Gordon Griffin Books called Bodhiyin Nights, which collects all the short stories that he's done. And he's done
that's set in this – are they all set in this world?
Most of them,
right,
yeah.
Okay.
And again, that's box. He's writing this during the height of the cyberpunk movement, and yet you're right, he's not entirely playing the cyberpunk game, because it's not virtual reality, it's people plugging
technology.
Cerebral cortex, so they can mimic a character, a fictional character. Or
read the blurb on the back of the book before we get too far into the book.
I'll read the blurb at the back of the book before we get too far into the book. It says, in a decadent world of cheap pleasures and easy death, Marid Adran, or Dran, it's probably a best, really good way of pronouncing it, but I don't know what it is, Marid, has kept his independence and his identity the hard way. Still, like everything else in the Bodhiyin, he is available for a price. For a new kind of killer roams the streets of the decadent Arabic ghetto, a madman whose bootleg personality cartridges range from sinister James Bond to a sadistic disemboweler named Khan. And Marid has been made an offer he can't refuse. The 200-year-old godfather of crime in the Bodhiyin has enlisted Marid as his instrument of vengeance. But first, Marid must undergo the most sophisticated of surgical implants before he dares to stop a killer with the powers of every psychopath since the beginning of time. Wry, savage and unforgettable, when gravity fails, is a major new work of dark genius by one of the most celebrated talents in science fiction today, a cutting-edge, heart-stopping tour de force detective story about an insane future world not so far removed from our own. That last paragraph is better than the first two paragraphs, because they're shit and they're terrible back copy. But Effinger was considered the up-and-coming. I mean, people swore by him. And you'll see there's a lot of – in the inset, quotes, Harlan Ellison, Orson Scott Card, Richard Lubov, Spider Robinson. They all respected him. The problem is he's now forgotten.
Yeah.
Because did you know of George Alec Effinger?
No, I hadn't even heard of him until you gave me this book.
That's why I wanted to do this book as well. Even if I – and if I ended up hating it, I wouldn't have recommended it. But because I did enjoy it in the end, why you give me that weird look?
But did you recommend it before you reread it?
Possibly.
Okay.
I knew he wouldn't let me down.
Okay.
I knew he wouldn't let me down. And he didn't, even though I did have issues with it.
Did it feel dated to you?
You know what? Yes, I'd read the word cartridge at the back there, and the core cartridges, the things that they plug, but
The complete lack of any personal communication devices.
Yeah, no one has a mobile phone. Yeah,
or anything. Any personal communication devices. You have him,
You're right.
Plot things revolve around him not being able to get to a phone to make a crucial phone call a few times.
I did know that, yeah.
Which I mean, again, 87. Mobile phones just coming into use.
I'm not Wikipedia-ing this.
Anyway.
I do vaguely remember mobile phones in the late 80s.
Yeah, so
but they were the big blocks.
The bricks, But to have no personal communication device, to again have you know, you were literally.
But to be fair, I wonder if that was just a choice that he made and not an omission.
Oh, yeah, possibly.
Because Star Trek
That's not necessarily a critique of the – it's just one of the things that makes it feel very dated now.
Yeah, well, the whole – Cyberpunk was a cul-de-sac, to be honest. Yes. I mean, no one's turning and saying, shit, didn't that predict stuff?
Yeah.
It predicted the internet. Well, it really didn't. It predicted humanity's possible reaction. And even that's not entirely accurate, our way we react to the internet and information and that.
Yeah.
You agree?
Well, no, I agree. I'm saying not that that's necessarily a severe critique of the book. It's just one of the elements that now, reading it now in 2012, it makes it feel really, really – because it is a futuristic book. The book is written, you know, it was the 20
– Yeah, it's 20-something or other.
Like really, really far future, not like, you know, 2050 or something like that. Yeah. So it's meant to be quite far future. And it's – yeah, it kind of doesn't – it doesn't feel –
Well, what?
Sorry, it's set in near the end of the 22nd century.
Yeah, but,
there we go.
But I don't see what. I'm just saying it feels.
That's just one thing. But I was kind of reading it as, I guess, kind of like an alternate future, as though back in 1987 the future just split, and this one went that way and we went this way. I guess they develop technology more along the lines of the add-ons and the modifications and stuff
like
that.
But you can look at it as that has – it's apps basically. I mean, these cartridges
are – Yeah, that's what I mean. Like that's where their technology went.
Yeah.
As opposed to our technology, which instead of going inside us yet
– is external.
Is on our phones and our
– Yeah.
Tablets and things like that. So that's what I mean. Like it was like an alternate future. It was kind of cool.
So I mean, he's obviously going for that feel of a sort of not Art Deco, but a 1950s noir sort of feel with a bit of techno thrown in.
Yeah, it reminded me very much of Neuromancer.
But here's the thing, Kirsten. Okay. You know, I asked this question, which you hate. The question you hate that you said I'm never allowed to ask again.
There's a few of them.
No, this one you really hate. This book is that question, which is, what if a white bloke wrote about a culture that is not his and about gender issues that he's...
But that's what he's done.
Exactly.
Here's your answer. This is what happens.
Now, and so because I vaguely remember the transgendered stuff. So
yeah,
one of the reasons why I really wanted to talk about this was to see, well, in 1987... Is he – if the Tiptree Award had been around because it wasn't, could this have been nominated for the Tiptree, or would people have said, let's take 2012's internet period – you know, this is published tomorrow, slightly updated. Is he going to get lambasted from having gender issues here and failing 101, or is he a Tiptree candidate? That's what I really wanted to discuss because I'm actually curious. I don't know the answer. I wanted to know your view.
I don't know. I did cringe quite a lot reading this book, and it's hard to tease out because this is we were talking about point of view before. This is a very immersive
first person. It's first person
point of view book. So you know you're just in the character's head. So it's hard to tease out character from, I guess, the greater world building. And I really didn't like him.
No, Murray's a bit of a dick.
At all. He's a complete dick.
Yeah.
And that made it a very...
But you'd argue no dickish...
It's a bit of a struggle to read just because, like, when you're in the head of a first-person narrative, I mean, when you're in a first-person narrative, you're in the head of that character for the whole... But if you hate that character, if you can't...
Did you actually hate him? So I didn't hate him. I just thought he was a bit of a prick,
too strong a word.
He's no different to any other noir first person Chandler X Hammett
and
sort.
I'm not a huge fan.
No, okay, yeah, right, yeah, that doesn't help. But I mean, you know, the sort of
so that's the problem.
I mean, in a sense, Murray is a bit of a cliche in that sense as a character. Although I think Effinger does interesting things with him.
He's also just really incompetent. Like he's got this overinflated sense of his own abilities, which are not borne out in the book at all. I mean, the only time, like, he kind of almost, I can't even think of an example where he actually discovers something or comes to a really crucial conclusion from his own investigative work or like everything is kind of it kind of happens by accident.
Yeah, he stumbles over the body of Nikki.
People push him into doing things.
He stumbles over the...
I mean, the whole Nikki thing, it's like he just walks away kind of thing.
He doesn't walk away. He gets bloody injured and put in a hospital.
Yeah, but after that he's like...
No, he's not.
No, before that, like when she's... Yeah, I don't know.
Oh, you mean when Nikki takes the money and he... He says he'll kill her if he next time he sees her.
But
you're not answering the question I asked.
Sorry.
He's a cock.
Yes.
I get he's a cock.
He's a bit.
All right?
Or and what he does to his girlfriend is...
He's a dickish thing, but I mean, guys do shit things to girls.
Yeah,
he's not abusive to her.
Oh, he's not?
He does belt her around at one point, yeah. Does he?
Yes, he does.
Yes, he does.
It's really explicit. And he says horrible things to her. And
that's what I was going to ask. Does he feel he can get away with it because she was once a bloke?
Because what he says, can we find – I probably can't find what he says.
So we don't have a Kindle version.
He says they're having an argument. They're outside. They're in an alley or something. So it's kind of private, but it's in an alley. And they're having an argument. I can't remember exactly what the argument's about. But
it was about him selling out.
Yeah, but I mean he grabs her head and he – bashes it against the brick wall, really deliberately. Like, I forget the exact words he uses in the narrative, but he's like he does it just because he could or something. That was like he said, and then his girlfriend Yasmin is a transgendered woman, and as almost every woman in this book is, by the way, he thinks they are.
Yeah,
yeah,
was interesting. I don't think the barmaid.
The barmaid isn't. The African barmaid, she's not. But so he grabs her head, he slams it against a brick wall in an alleyway just because he can. And then when she swears at him and says something in retaliation, he says something like, come retaliate or something, or if you're man enough to do it. And he calls her mutilated and gelded. I mean, it's awful. It's really, really awful. And the thing is, people have fights, and when you're in a relationship and you're fighting, sometimes you dredge up the most awful things you can possibly think of to say to someone, even if sometimes that's what happens.
Yeah.
And he's like, immediately he's kind of like, that's
terrible.
Yeah,
he was regretful of, he doesn't go, whoa, that was a real clever, witty
remark. But the thing is, like, what happens after that? They don't split up. That kind of tells me this is not the first time that's happened. She's not that, she's not shocked by what he's said and done.
Yeah, so you
So that tells me this isn't the first time that's happened. You know, because, like, even if she doesn't, like, I'm not saying, she goes, that's it, we're done, we're through, we're over.
Yeah.
But the fact that she doesn't seem at all shocked by it tells me that that's not a new thing.
Yeah, no, that's a fair point.
And he is abusive, verbally, maybe, possibly physically as well, but he certainly must be verbally abusive in the relationship. And to throw her sexuality at her as part of the abuse is just awful. He's an awful, awful boyfriend.
But what do we say about Effinger on that? What's the comment back to the author?
Well, I don't know, because you see, the character, I think, is a dick. Like, I don't it's hard to be able to tease out my reaction to a character.
Yeah.
And say, well, is this what the author is intending? I don't know. If the author is intending him to be really cool and this is a guy we can get behind, then I'm very uncomfortable with that. I think it's sort of like, this is not going to become a 10-minute conversation, I promise, but it's like the new Sherlock Holmes. I have a real problem with the new Sherlock because I think he is an incredibly cruel person, and I think we're kind of meant to celebrate that, and we're meant to find it funny, and we're meant to be kind of, it's Sherlock, that's how he is, and he's meant to be cool, and I just find
You think we're condoning him?
Yeah, and I'm not saying that that's what Effinger's doing with Marid, because, it's really hard to tease out of a first-person narrative. The other thing Marid does, he's got this horrible cockiness that he carries throughout the entire book, that when he says over and over and over, and he calls – I mean, the language in the book talks about transgendered people as sex changers.
Yeah.
That's what and that's a term that kind of made me cringe a bit. But 1987, I don't know. Anyway, but Merida's got this thing where he like picks people. He like walks past her, goes, "Oh yeah, that, oh yeah, she was definitely a
Actually, that shat me as well. That really.
And this is a point of personal pride for him that he can tell.
Yeah. But I don't think he takes pride in the fact that he's man enough to be shagging a transgendered person. I think he just feels he's a cocky guy. Oh yeah, she was a bloke once.
But why should that matter?
It doesn't. You know? No, you're right. You're right.
It's really.
You're right. And so, again, you got to ask, what's Evanjib doing here? What games are you playing?
Yeah. So I don't. And again,
it's just saying it's not that crunchy.
Or is it? It's not that crunchy. I think there's a lot to talk about around the book. I think within the book. And the other
you'd say it'd be ripped apart today if this was published today, as it is with mobile phones, possibly.
with mobile phones,
this would not be on the tip tree list.
Probably not as it's written now, because I don't think. I mean, the other problem is again also, and I don't cut it a lot of slack for this, but it is the first in a trilogy, so I don't know what the ultimate character arc. From a read is
whether and by, anyone who's read
by the
trilogy,
end of the third book, whether there is any kind of self revelatory stuff happening.
Anyone who's read
where
the trilogy,
he
feel free
he's being
to
a bit of a dick.
Tell us if there is. although I don't think many people listening to this will have read any Effinger.
Yeah. So I don't know. His cockiness. That scene at the end when he takes the girl who was at. I can't remember any of the characters' names because it was actually quite a boring mystery plot.
You really didn't like this, did you?
No, I'm sorry, I didn't.
I think it's convoluted, the mystery plot. It falls apart because, I mean, the whole Nero Wolf thing.
It really
falls
apart.
Well, it gets too convoluted. It gets nonsensically convoluted.
And again,
convoluted.
You have this character who, again, is kind of, he's not really that. Efficient or able or...
Well, he does save the day.
Like, by accident.
Yeah. He's not bloody Inspector Gadget. It's not Maxwell Smart.
But he starts out saying he is. He starts out saying, he's really good.
Anyway, you were saying about the last scene.
What was I saying? Oh, with the girl that they find at the dead guy's place. The blonde German girl.
Yeah,
And...
Who he basically plays along.
Yeah, he takes her back to a hotel room and they have a one-night stand.
Yeah.
And she's this really beautiful German blonde girl. And this, I think, we actually can lay at Effinger's feet because she leaves him – like, she's this beautiful blonde German girl. She's sort of involved in the case because she was a kind of a witness at one remove. And they end up going back to his hotel or her – his hotel and having a one-night stand.
Because he's gotten a room. He's pretending to be an Arab diplomat or something. Yeah.
So, because he's undercover. Yes. Kind of. Well, he's actually hiding. Yeah. He's not undercover. He's hiding.
Yeah.
So they go back, have a one-night stand. He wakes up. She's gone, as one-night stands do. But she's left him a note. And the note is kind of like, oh, I had a good time, blah, blah, blah. You were really nice to me. By the way, my real name is, and I can't remember what the name was, but the upshot of, or the punchline of the note is that, oh, actually, she's a guy, or she used to be a guy.
Yeah.
And he's kind of a bit shocked because, again, he thought he could tell. And he could tell because it's
is that taking him down a notch, though?
What's used to take him down a notch? A woman, a transgendered woman, who is seems to me from the limited time we're given her on screen, seems to me to be a very happy, well-balanced, transgendered woman.
Yes.
Why would she turn around to a guy she's basically just had sex with and say, oh, by the way,
I'm a bloke. Yeah.
Why would that happen if not just, as you say, to have in the text this character kind of going, oh, maybe I can't always pick up.
Well, that's a good point.
Which I think is a really, that was just a really icky thing.
But that's also a good point, the idea of the well-balanced transgendered person, because Yasmin's not well-balanced.
No, well, but
she's a bit crazy. Yeah. Well, look, I don't know. I suppose, you know, it's hard to have this discussion without sounding like a complete dickhead.
I think it's important to note with this book that it's all set in the, the underbelly side of things. I mean, this is not
in a Muslim quarter as well. which we haven't spoken about.
But this is not a place where rich
where rich successful people go to do something dirty and
this is like a ghettoized type of an area. So the fact that
which explains Murid to a degree.
It does explain Murid to a degree.
But, and his friends are dickheads as well.
So I did get the impression from the book that Murid's acceptance and the acceptance of the transgendered women by the, I can't remember if there was a single
I don't think there was a single
transgendered man. I think they're all transgendered women. Yeah. So his I'm going to say quasi acceptance because anyone who plays spot the transgender throughout his entire life and wants a Boy Scout badge for doing it I'm not sure that's truly accepting. But anyway, but I think the tacit acceptance you have of that in this book, the fact that it's all in this ghetto, I think maybe says something about how it's accepted in the wider society.
Which that it isn't.
Which that it probably isn't.
Well, we know it isn't because Nikki is from that wider society and was rejected for being what she is.
So it's not that they're...
And that's a plot point.
So it's not as though this is a future where we are post-gender and... post-race, because people changed their physical...
But Corey's new bike was the same.
Yeah.
It's also not accepted.
Oh, yeah, I know. I'm saying, but I have seen a couple of reviews where they're talking about this book as being, it's a post-gender book and a post-race book, because there are characters who have changed their physical racial characteristics as well to transmute... I guess that's a word.
You go with it.
Yeah. So that they will change their physical characteristics so they now look Asian instead of white.
I'm just curious, what do the reviews say? Because I didn't really
There's not many of them. In fact, they were actually – I found one sort of, I guess, mainstream review as opposed to just people saying stuff on blogs and at Goodreads and things. So that there's actually not a lot, but a couple people were sort of – a couple people going, ooh, the transgender stuff was a bit weird. And a couple of people were saying, oh, it's really good. It's kind of like it's all accepting and everything. But I don't think it is accepting. I think the attitudes towards it in the ghettoized area by necessity kind of reflect an opposite view outside of that.
Yeah, I mean, we haven't spoken about the Islamic side, which it's interesting how he treats that Effinger, whether he treats that with respect. There's no doubt that the religious people in this book, except for one, a doctor, are pretty evil and bad. So there's that sense that...
But pretty much everyone is.
Yeah,
I mean, this
problem.
Is a thing. Everyone in this book
you
is
could
pretty
say,
much
well,
awful.
You could conflate Islam equals evil because the Islamic people in the book are pretty fucked, especially the godfather, the Friedlander Bey, is a manipulative arsehole and obviously a religious... Muslim. He's not someone who's he prays seven times, so five times. Anyway, he prays often, and that there is a doctor though who's quite religious, who's a nice bloke.
The German guy's not Muslim,
and he's an evil bastard. Yeah, you're right.
I think just everyone in this book is
you're
really
right. Everyone is
it's
pretty
an icky environment.
Yeah, it's a dirty place.
Yeah,
but I still enjoyed it. I agree with you. Yeah, I agree with you that look, here's a terrible thing. When I was a little child reading this, when I was in my 20s reading this, I dare say I would have thought of this as exotic.
Yeah.
But that's a terrible word. Because as an adult, you don't use the word exotic because exotic means look at them, they're different to us. And let's give them let's throw bits of bread at them.
Line them up for photographs.
I still think though, and I know this doesn't really count for much, that – it is quite a bold book in many ways because it does a completely different culture, sets in a different culture with a certain type of style and has that transgendered and gendered element to it, which wasn't common in 1980. Well, I don't know how common it was in 1987. I can't think it was that common. Cyberpunk maybe brought a bit of that stuff out.
Maybe. I don't know how
– Jonathan and Gary would know.
I don't think it was that common. I think it's – when you're talking about the transgender stuff, I think it kind of does fall into the trap of but again, it's hard to tell because you've got all of this techno development. So even the characters who just change their kind of racial appearance are beautiful. I mean, everyone, like, it seems like anyone, and you would, I guess, if you've had extensive modification, you would be aiming for a kind of beauty standard that's more widely acceptable. But it just seemed like there was almost this exotic-fication. I don't know if that's definitely not a word. But there was this.
I don't think there was. I think I disagree.
I know, because all of the transgender women were these beautiful, ethereal.
But that's because how they modify. But I don't think he does that to show this is an exotic culture or an exotic transgender people are exotic. I don't think he plays that line.
Maybe
I'm wrong, but I think
I don't know. I thought there was a little. As I said, it's hard to tease out.
And he seems to be true to pretty. Not that he's a Muslim, but. I think he's been pretty respectful to the faith in terms of the prayers and the things that would be said and all that sort of stuff. So I don't know. I think it's George Alec Effinger is basically a forgotten writer. Let's be frank here. That this book was published in 1987. He died in 2002. He was not very healthy for a good chunk of his life. He didn't finish. He wrote a fourth book in this series, which he didn't get to finish. All his work is maybe except for the Golden Griffin stuff, although I think even that's out of print. So he's out of print.
Yeah.
A podcast. If he was in Up in the Sky at the moment, he'd be going, shit, what? There's a podcast, whatever the fuck that is, talking about me? Whoa. Because really, other than the so-called baby boomer fans in their late 50s, early 60s now, no one of our ilk or younger is going to read George Alec
Effinger. He's certainly not like a William Gibson or an Neal Stephenson.
And the question
he hasn't come through.
No, he hasn't survived.
As part of, I guess, canon.
And the question is whether he should stay disappeared, dead, whatever. Well, he's going to stay dead. He's got no choice there. But whether he should stay, which he should just go to the mists of time and never to be thought of again, or whether we should highlight this author and his work. I know what you think. You, if you never read another George Alec Effinger book again, I don't think you'd be too upset.
I certainly wasn't. Yeah, look, it's not a terrible book. I'm probably making it out to be worse than I.
It's definitely not unreadable.
No, it's fine. You read through it. I didn't like the main character much, which was hard. To be in his head for all that time. It's not that big a book either. So, and there are some very interesting things I like. The technology side of what it didn't do was interrogate the idea of all of these physical modifications.
Oh, yes, it does. No, that's central to it. I think you're wrong. He doesn't want to be modified. That's crucial.
Yeah, he does.
He doesn't want to be modified, so there is that interrogation because he's against it. What does it do to you? What does it do to your brain? And then he has
that's
to
only
be.
The add-ons and the stuff in your head.
Yeah.
That's what he doesn't want to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm talking about all of the physical modifications that people have been doing.
He doesn't have any of those either.
No, but a lot of people don't. But the book, it kind of skates over the top of things like that.
I don't agree with you. No, because, okay. I mean, he makes the point
that thought it would be a lot more complicated. It's a lot more complicated than what he makes it out to be.
Well, he spent that time on the plot, which is far too complicated. Did you actually understand the last 20 pages?
Skimmed the last 20 pages.
You didn't finish the book.
No, look, I did finish the book. I didn't care. By the end of it, I actually did not
give a damn about the
noir detective plot at all. I didn't care who killed who or why they killed anyone.
There are some great bits of writing in this. Great bits of noir writing.
There are some really good bits, but I think in terms of a hardball detective thing, and maybe that's the problem. Maybe it's been pitched to be something that it isn't, although I think it is trying very hard to be a noir, cyberpunk noir.
I accept that it's trying to be too hard.
And I think the detective stuff just falls flat. He's it really does, and it's such a convoluted crime at the end and there's such convoluted ways that my read gets to solve it By the end of it I didn't care. I did not care about the actual crime
story.
That's
fine. It's your opinion. I don't know if it's right. Harlan Ellison says of it, This is the fourth or fifth time I've been asked to give a public comment on an Effinger book. And each time I've done it, and each time I've said, you people are cheating yourselves if you don't forego food and rent to pick up on Effinger's work. Now this time you will, for Pete's sake, listen to me and buy When Gravity Fails. It's as crazy as a spider on ice skates. Plain old terrific. And if you don't pay attention, I'll have to get tough with you. We Have Your Children and Your Dog by Reed and Marvel or else. Well, Harlan, no one obviously listened because 25 years. I don't know how that sold, but 25 years later. Well, he did another two books. So
yeah,
probably
another
sold
two
okay.
And was remember, working
this,
on a fourth.
Remember, this was the day of the Midlist where you could actually yes. sell, you know, seven books and still have a contract. So, look, I'm of the view that we should remember George Alec Effinger. He has a place, not maybe not in the canon per se, but a place in the history of the genre rather than just a footnote. I think these are important books because although they may not do the transgender stuff well, or even the cultural stuff well, there's an attempt.
I think
there's an attempt here. And I would be interested to know what other people think. I know what you think.
Yeah.
And they all agree with you, and I might get screamed out as class. But
I think I did appreciate the, I guess, the attempt at normalization of the gender stuff.
Yeah. Well, that's what I thought the most. In spite of the abusive stuff.
What I didn't appreciate was the
She's transgendered.
Well, the incessant kind of patting himself on the back for being so normalizing of the transgender stuff. That's really the sense that I got from this character, that he was like, hey, I'm cool with it. High five. It was like,
that's brilliant. I wish that's what it should be, the tagline. Hey, I'm cool with it. Oh, man.
High five.
Be a slap. Yeah, high five.
Yeah. And that's which means it actually isn't normalised.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. I know in the Westwood, to go back to that,
yeah.
It's absolutely normalised. It is just the same. It is the game. It isn't for the society outside, but the way Kim Ride said it feels normalised.
Yeah, yeah.
And I get what you're saying.
But, I mean, she is writing it from the point of view of the character.
Yeah,
who's with the gender identity,
yeah.
As opposed to someone who's outside of that identity writing about someone else with it.
I mean, Effinger, if he was here, might just say, look, it's a very – considering it's in an Islamic or Muslim ghetto where these women would – these transgender people would normally be spat upon, but they're allowed to exist in this sort of fashion.
We don't exactly know the whole politics of the greater world. We are in this ghetto. We don't actually get a lot of politics of the greater world in this book.
No, we don't. But Effinger might say, well, for a guy who isn't transgendered, he's in the world he's living in, he's reasonably accepting. That's what you.
Yeah, no, I think Murray definitely is.
I quite keep thinking you say Murray.
Murray. He is. He's just a bit of an ass.
Well, my view is, go if you haven't read it already, and we actually haven't spoiled that much of it in terms of plot.
No, we really haven't. We haven't really said anything about the mystery side of it at all.
Possibly because we didn't entirely understand it. I think I would like to hear more people reading When Gravity Fails to know whether it is true and Effinger should just go with The Mists of Time or whether
I don't think it has to be more than just a foot.
Well, what's the middle ground?
Well,
some people will like him and some people won't.
That is the middle ground.
But
actually,
it's not the middle ground though, because authors like this, and yes, I know they're white blokes and all that, and all that shit. But
authors like this,
authors of the mid-80s, midlist authors of the mid-80s, okay. Are a dime a dozen. No, the other pops are a dime a dozen. They're everywhere.
Everywhere.
And there are some of them who I think deserve to be elevated again, not to be forgotten. That is all I'm saying. And I think George Alec Effinger is one of them.
Okay.
And some people will agree, and some people say we're quite happy that he's no longer spoken about.
Yeah, but
because you struggled to find stuff on him, didn't you?
I did in terms of – probably because when the book came out, all of the, I guess, the significant venues that reviews would have been in were print.
Yeah, but Neuromancer 2 years before.
Yeah. Well, that is continuing to be written about.
That's right. This isn't, yeah. nor is any of his work.
No, but I mean, well, to be fair, it's like Neuromancer's head and shoulders above this book.
Is it really?
It really is. Mm. It really is.
When was the last time you read Neuromancer?
Oh, 3-4 years ago.
Mm. Okay.
I think as a, not in terms of whether or not it's dated or
you just think on a sentence by sentence level.
As a novel, as a piece of craft, it's a much better book.
Has a better opening line.
Oh, killer opening line. Yeah. But that's it. It is a better book.
Well, look,
so whether it deserves to be elevated because of its significant contribution to the genre or just because it's a better book, I think you can't get around that.
Well, call me terrible. I thought I'd broaden the minds of our listeners and get them to read something a little bit different and actual science fiction, which we don't really
do. It is science. No, it's definitely science
and
fiction.
And they who probably haven't read it, but if you have read it, I would love to know what you think, whether you think he's worthy of being remembered.
I think.
And it's not an either, it's not a, it is an either or because people just get forgotten.
Not forever by everyone.
Well, no, their family usually remember them. We hope if they have. But, I'm curious to know, of our listeners, of the few hundred we have, who has actually read a George Alec Effinger prior to this book? Curious to know. So feedback, if you don't give it to me, I will scream. And you can do it on the Twitter thing, right on the critic, which we'll get to in a second.
Yes.
All right, they're the two books done.
So that's it. We're under 2 hours.
What are we at the moment?
Well under 2 hours, actually. We're only just over an hour and a half. Thank you, Jonathan.
Yeah, Jonathan.
Okay, so I think we can wrap up.
We can.
So I'm going to tell people to, as Ian just said, send us feedback. You can follow us on Twitter, Writer and Critic. Or you can comment at the website, which is writerandcritic.podbean.com, or email us your feedback to writerandcritic@gmail.com. Or, as always, you can leave us the rating of your choice.
5 stars.
On iTunes.
5 stars. Now, wait. I want to do one thing.
Yes.
I want to congratulate Coot Street and Galactic Suburbia
for the Hugo
being
nomination.
Nominated for the Hugo.
Yes.
And I actually think they're in with the show.
That's wonderful.
And I think they're genuinely in with the show. I think there could be an Australian Hugo.
It's really good to see Australian podcasts getting obviously a much, much wider audience than just in Australia.
Yes. No, genuinely, no sarcasm, no cynicism, no jokes. I am genuinely proud of them. And I really, really do honestly believe that they are both in with the show and could take the trophy home.
That'd be awesome.
Not actually a trophy. It's more a rocket ship.
It's a rocket ship. That's a trophy.
Well, I suppose you could call it that.
Trophies, anything you get given. Okay. They got something, or they might get something.
So I just wanted to throw that in because it's important to note, to acknowledge our friends.
I think, well. So,
I mean, there were three other podcasts I ain't got shit about, but I want to acknowledge those two. Actually, the other three podcasts I've never heard. The SF Signal one.
Yep.
And I think Tony Thingy's there. I've heard his, Steampunk, whatever. And what was the third? Something else.
Starship Sofa.
No, yeah, Starship Sofa. Yeah. I've heard that. SF Signal. There was a third.
Oh, I thought you said Steampunk something.
Steampunk. Yeah, I probably did. there was a third one. I'm sorry to the Functional Nerd, maybe. Something like that. Anyway, I apologize.
Ian doesn't care. He's very jingoistic.
Yeah. Exactly.
Okay, next episode, which will be May. I can't believe it's the end of April already. Next episode, I have recommended Sea Hearts by Margot Lanigan.
And in Australian Quinella, female Australian Quinella, I've recommended Bad Power by Deborah Biancotti.
Yes.
You should both, well, you, whoever you are, should buy both books.
Both of our listeners should buy both the books.
Straight away, if you haven't already. I just wanted to say that May's an average, ordinary podcast. We're going to do it. We'll sit around this table.
Yes.
We'll laugh. We'll cry. We'll talk about those two books. Whatever. But following that, I just want to get a bit of excitement.
Bit of
anticipation.
Bit
of spoilers. I won't say what.
No.
But there are three massive, huge, mother fudger podcasts coming up. We've got Guests Out of the Wazoo, a bunch of books I've never heard of, but apparently I've got to read, and all sorts of other little surprises, which I'm only being told about today that I'm aware of, that I'm not entirely happy about. So it is the month. Let's just put it to you this way. The month of June, I may not survive.
Yeah, me too. Hey, you're the one who has to put it all together at the end.
I don't care. What I will say is that please come to our panel at Continuum because we'll be doing
a live writer and critic again at Continuum, which is the National Science Fiction Convention this year in Melbourne. So if you're in Melbourne or if you're planning to come to Melbourne around about the Queen's Birthday long weekend, please come
to
our –
What dates is it?
It's a Queen's Birthday long weekend.
Yes, for people who
it's
don't.
About the 10th or 11th. Oh, Google it, people.
It, but the Queen's Birthday in Victoria, because it's different,
yes,
in other
in Victoria.
States.
Well, I did say the convention was in Melbourne.
Yeah. You're smart. So, yes, I just want to say it's going to be
it's going to be huge.
It's going to change the face of the podcast forever.
Is it?
Not really, no, because we'll just get back to normal after that. And I can't believe we're going to do Infinite Jest and House of Leaves in December. I love how you bought the book, though. You've seen how big the type is, Infinite Jest.
You've lent me that copy.
Oh, is that mine?
That's your copy. I've had that for two years.
Fuck. All right. Anyway, it's a good time
to finish.
All right,
we're going. We'll see you next month. Enjoy the Lanigan and the Bean Coddy, and we shall talk about them.
We hopefully will. Bye.
Bye. We hopefully will.
Yeah, well, you know, we may not survive next month.
No, next month's May. It's June, we're not surviving.
Oh, yeah. Oh, well, then we'll be there.
Maybe we can talk about ponies.
Oh, fuck the ponies.